Yesterday I went to the Catholic Church up the street, just for old time's sake. It was Good Friday, and there were about this many people in the church, which is, as you may know, the churches are usually open between 12 and 3 on Good Friday, during what, according to one tradition at least, is the hours of the crucifixion. And sometimes they have various ceremonies going on, but yesterday I was kind of pleased to see there was nothing going on. And as you may also know, they basically remove every bit of decoration from the church on after the so-called Mass of the Lord's Supper on Thursday before, and they take everything out. So there are no candles, there are no draperies, there are no flowers. All the decorative bits are gone. And the there's usually a light that's kept burning all the time. The sacristy light, that's extinguished. And the tabernacle where the consecrated wafers are kept is opened and empty. Oh, and the baptismal pool is empty, is drained also. So it's actually quite powerful. And then used to be there was a late, like a midnight Mass service on, it would be tonight, but for some reason the trend now is to make them much earlier, so the service will be at 7:30, which doesn't amount to much of a vigil as far as I can tell, but anyway, then all the stuff is back, and the place is festively decorated for Easter, so the contrast is quite sharp. And then, of course, in the old days, apparently, when people took such things as Lent more seriously, and people were actually fasting and so forth, and then they'd go to this late service on the vigil of Easter. And they'd be kind of a little bit high, so the service was quite powerful. I think we've lost that a little bit nowadays. We don't have access to that kind of experience now that we're all so sophisticated, and we don't fall for that stuff. But the one question that I have is how do we keep these traditions from becoming dead? Because it's very easy. I mean, I didn't know anybody in the church, naturally, but and some people were, you know, reading something, or one guy was walking around doing what they call the Stations of the Cross, and other people were just kind of, I was just sitting there doing our practice, which we do everywhere. But it wasn't so easy to see whether the tradition was alive in more than just the observances. And of course, that is a danger for us and for every other tradition that concerns itself at all with being passed on to another generation. Because if you're going to do that, you're going to have to pass something along to your kids, for instance. One of the ways that the clergy in Zen is talked about, at least around the Zen Center, this seems to be some truth in this, is that the clergy people pass on the stuff, the tangible and observable trappings, if you will, of the Buddha way. But of course, that's not really enough. Somehow, the actual spirit of the practice, which we say goes back to Shakyamuni and seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni and primordial Buddhas before that, that somehow has to be well, kept alive isn't quite the right word. That makes it sound like a, you know, hamster or something in a cage that you feed and give water to. It's not quite like that. It's more like spirit is indestructible, but how does the body-mind that enshrines that awareness, that spirit, how is that acknowledged generation after generation in every practitioner? And if that's not happening, then what is happening? So there's a tendency, I'm afraid, for spiritual and other traditions that extend beyond the boundaries of one generation to get kind of solidified and dead. And then you have usually just a corpse. And then you have people fighting over the corpse. And as the corpse decomposes, people get more and more excited about not letting that happen. And then, next thing you know, you have wars. People, burning each other at the stake and so forth. So honestly, I don't know how they handle that in the Catholic or Christian world nowadays, or if they do. There's a certain assumption that the what's called the Holy Spirit will just take care of everything. Well, maybe. I mean, in a way, yes, that's true. But again, how will the heartfelt acknowledgement and love of that be encouraged to emerge over and over again in every generation? How will that be handled? Back in the day, there was a kind of a job that certain people had. And since I'm busily recycling topics for a talk, excuse me if I brought this up before, but the person known as the mystagogue, have you heard that word? The mystagogue was the one who pointed the way so that new generations of initiates could enter the mystery. This was most obviously true in the so-called mystery religions of the ancient world, about which I think not a great deal is known because they were largely managed in secret. But the mystagogue was the one who herded the initiates together and instructed them and enabled them by means of the tangible aspects of the tradition to encounter for themselves the mystery. So tonight, up at the Catholic Church, there will be display. I don't mean to denigrate it exactly, just there will be a mystagogic event when the candidates for baptism, the adult candidates for baptism, will be invited to the front of the congregation early on in the vigil service, and they will be ushered by their mystagogue, someone who's been involved in their instruction in this period leading up to their baptism, and they will be received into the congregation as new initiates. And the hope is that the Spirit will take care of the mystery part, because managing that is not any longer something that is consciously or deliberately taken in hand. So as a result, the possibility is that what's being passed on from generation to generation is a kind of a corpse. It might almost be enough to, if we just, as humans, we could remind each generation that, look, we're handing you a corpse. Here you are. It's your job to make it alive again. That would be maybe a good place to start. But in a tradition where the trappings or accoutrements don't encode an initiatory experience in a way that people can still access, you got a big problem. So we're also on thin ice, but maybe not quite as thin, because we have an initiatory practice and phenomenon, which if people bring themselves wholeheartedly to it, pretty much obliges them to encounter the mystery of their own being, which is the heart of all of these traditions, in spite of the tendency for that to be kind of exteriorized and replaced with a sort of historical narrative, which I'm afraid is happening in certain quarters of Christianity and maybe Islam and maybe other faiths, just because that's how it tends to happen. So the narrative of awakening is replaced by a sort of pseudo-history. And people, they try to feel good about the fact, well, Jesus came to earth and was crucified and rose from the dead in fulfillment of the scriptures, as they say. That's a very cool thing. But the narrative of awakening that is, and I swear, and Joseph Campbell agrees with me, is embedded in that story, has kind of gotten lost sight of. And some would say that, like in Japan, same thing happened. The narrative of awakening has become a kind of historical narrative. Oh, Dogen did this and Buddha did that, and sitting in Zazen is itself the Buddha way. And yet that is the corpse talking. So we, in America anyway, this guy Suzuki Roshi, it's part of our historical narrative, came over and he was our mystagogue. He was the one who ushered us towards the initiatory experience of encountering the mystery. And so we've been trying to make sure that each generation has access to that initiatory experience through the gateless gate of practice, or zazen. I don't know how we're doing, but that's what we try to do. So we say, you know, in our little Zen poem, the merging of difference and unity, or whatever it's called this week, Adina and I were looking at some of the Chinese characters, which don't make a lot of sense, actually. Right now, but there is this line that's translated, humbly address mystery people. That's you. Don't waste your time. And interestingly, in Suzuki Roshi's lectures on the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and equality, he doesn't talk about that line. He talks about don't waste time. He doesn't talk about studying the mystery. So I was a little bit surprised. I hadn't read the book in a while, and I'm paging through it looking for where he's going to talk about the mystery, and he doesn't. He doesn't say a word. So the mystery is that about our, not just our practice, but our being, our human life, that has to be encountered completely, personally, and intimately. No one else can do anything more than point and prepare. No one else can do anything more than be the mystagogue, however low-key and temporary that may be. And all of us must, as the poem says, study the mystery without wasting time. So one way we do that is to sit down and still the body and allow the mind to be quiet, which can seem to take a very long time. And it will if we're waiting for it. You've heard the expression, a watched pot never boils. Well, this pot doesn't seem to stop boiling. So you really do have to stop applying heat. And that means you got to see how you do that, how you apply heat. Even when you swear, I swear to God, I am not applying heat and it's still boiling. Then the mystagogue has to say, look, actually, if it's still boiling, you are applying heat. This is called physics, if you like. Nothing can boil without heat. So watch for the ways, ever more subtle, that you're applying heat, and the boiling will subside. And that whole process of engagement is studying the mystery of being. Not the mystery of sitting cross-legged, which is rather trivial, but the mystery of being, which is inexhaustible, unfathomable, and pretty great, as my teacher says. So one of the sections in that book, Suzuki Roshi's book, is question and answer. And one of the questioners there at the very end of the book, when he's just talked about this, don't waste time, someone's saying something like, you know, after this talk, we're going to recite the four vows, and I can't say them because, you know, I don't feel it. I know it's nothing I can do, so I can't say it. And Suzuki Roshi's like, I think you're getting kind of tangled up in your intellectualizing the whole matter here. The Bodhisattva vows are not about compassing their meaning with your intellect. He doesn't use those exact words. And the person who's asking the question doesn't buy it. You know, says, well, you know, still, I just think I just can't say it, you know. And Suzuki Roshi winds up saying, well, I hear where you're coming from, but you know, right now, I can't be your friend. It's kind of interesting he used that expression, I can't be your friend. Like, I'm not going to join you in that. I'm sorry, I think you're wrong. And you should, you know, what I'm saying is, You're trying to make a package out of the Bodhisattva vows and tie it up with the ribbon of intellectual understanding, and you're just strangling yourself. And so I'm not going to be your friend in that spot. And that's how they left it. So I thought, okay, this is good. This is where the mystagogue can say, look, you're missing the mystery, and you're getting tied up in the wrappings. So I'm inviting you not to do that. And I don't know what happened to that person. Maybe at some point they found they could say Bodhisattva vows as an utterance of the mystery, not as something you can weigh with in the balance of intellect and decide, yeah, that's reasonable, I'll say that. It's like, that has nothing to do with it. It is not reasonable. And Sukarshi says, in fact, it's completely unreasonable. That's what it's about. That's where it touches the unreasonableness and the unfathomability of being. That's what it's about. And the only way you're going to encounter that is by letting this body manifest the mystery and watching that. So I guess I'd say that's kind of what we're doing. And with this perhaps slightly overdone mystagogy here, with you know, this robe I've decided actually is too big. So it's like I was thinking, there's that old song, Sam, you made the pants too long. Well, they made this too big. It's like, okay. So here I am, wrapped in the robes of the mystagogue, you know, urging the congregation to study the mystery. That's about all I can do, folks. The study is everyone's individual, not just responsibility, but joy. And to allow and acknowledge the manifestation of that Buddha spirit in every generation is the great work. So I'm happy to be joining you in studying that mystery, which basically is never ending. And even when the Abhidharma Kosha tells us there's a stage called the end of study, that just means you've fallen into the mystery and are drowning in it. That's all that means. It doesn't mean you're actually not studying it anymore. It means you don't need any more convincing. The so-called ashaiksha marga, no more study, means you're drowning in mystery, and it's cool. So we've got about 7 times more cookies than people here today, and I guess that's good news, except that now we're told that sugar is killing you. So kind of took some of the fun out of the cookie business, at least for me. I don't know if you read the New York Times, but last Sunday there was a chilling article about sugar and its lethal effects. So it's like, oh no, I was having such fun eating cookies, and now look. Anyway, we got a lot of cookies, but maybe you might have some questions or comments. All of you have had some experience in other faith traditions, even the so-called secular faith tradition, whatever that is. So maybe you actually encountered some degree of mystagogy in your own upbringing, in which case it might be interesting to hear about that. I didn't very much at all, a little bit. But mostly, looking back, it was coming from me. The personnel, the mystagogic personnel, were pretty heavy-handed in my day. I was telling somebody the other day, he said he'd been to, this is my friend Jim, he'd had to take his friend Joe to the hospital, emergency room, because Joe had swallowed a fish bone. It got stuck in his throat, so he had to have it removed or something. And I was reminded that in the Catholic Church, I don't know if they still do it, but there was a blessing of the throats, the St. Blaise Day. St. Blaise was somehow the patron of the throat. I can't remember the story there. But anyhow, we were, you know, little Catholic kids, and they'd herd you over to the church. And then one of these feast days of St. Blaise, Monsignor Cummins, who was the pastor of this, at the time, large Catholic parish in Burlingame, he'd come around with these blessed candles, not lit, and two crossed candles and put them against your throat and utter this blessing. So I was next to my little friend, Albie Miller, who was giggling uncontrollably. This is going on. Here comes Monsignor Cummins. And I'm like, shut up, here he comes. Anyway, he couldn't help it. He was giggling. So Monsignor Cummins comes and grabs him by the throat with the candles and says, what's funny about it? So this was mystagogy back in the day. And I don't know how effective that was. It was a very, quite a mystagogic church. It was pseudo-Gothic. It's kind of ugly in a way, but soaring vaulted ceilings with decorations, candles everywhere, and incense and chanting. It was the atmosphere was very mystagogic, but the actual instruction was very weak and very heavy on the historical narrative. That's what we were being given, you know. Jesus died for you, little boy. Oh, thank you, that's cool. It's like, what does that mean for this? Hello? Well, there were a few around, not in my day. You know, if I often say if I'd met Brother David back in the day, things might be very different. I might be a Catholic monk now, but I didn't. And I tried, I don't know if some of you have noticed, sometimes I try sneaking back over that way. Every time I do that, I get over there and I think, Jesus, nobody around here thinks like I do about this. This is my experience at New Camaldoli when I spent the month down there a couple of years ago. It's like, well, this is really wonderful, but if I actually talk to people about how I'm experiencing this, and I did just to the one guy, the novice master, and he pretty much said, I wouldn't do this if I were you. You're going to feel like, you know, a fish out of water here. These other folks, they don't think that way. They're into the historical narrative, you know. It's like, oh, Jesus, wobbling back and forth and stuff. And I'm like, I can't do this. So maybe you had a similar experience. But anyway.
I did too.
Yeah.
I do have a question about our tradition, and one that, you know, it's kind of been on my mind for quite a while, and that is around when you talk about passing on a practice to the next generation.
Yeah.
It, to me, I mean, one of the things that really delayed my being able to practice was having small children and not being able, you know, to engage with any type of sangha, not that there were a lot around for me anyway, but having children also was prohibitive. So I'm kind of curious if that's not, or what, one, why that is the case, and secondly, how does, do you see that as an obstacle to engaging? Because what I actually did was, even though I didn't have a strong commitment to the Christian faith, I did go to a Christian church because, largely because they had things going on, activities going on that I could connect
for children
with, and resonate
with children
for myself, and in terms of like sponsoring people to go to Chiapas or and go to El Salvador.
So this was not a conservative,
conservative
congregation, obviously.
No, it wasn't at all. And but yes, they did have programs for my children. And also, I think it did have actually a big influence on my oldest daughter in terms of the work that she's doing now. So I think in terms of, so can you comment on that?
Just to make sure, when you say it was prohibitive for someone with children, prohibitive of what? That is what?
Sitting. And both having the support. Well, not having support for myself, for one thing, I wouldn't have had. And then also being able to participate in the Sangha because, essentially, if there's not a children's program going on as a parent, you're pretty much on your own to try to figure out how you're going to handle that.
Well, this is certainly an issue, and one factor here is that Buddhism is still pretty young in this country, in the West, and some of those adaptations to the actual circumstances of our Western life are just barely developing. You may know at Zen Center, you know, they have that coming of age program.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an attempt to introduce this mystagogic aspect of practice to a new generation. As you may know, infant baptism was a relatively recent development, and initiatory experiences were not thought to be appropriate for children at all for a long, long time. And then, of course, a lot of, in fact, just about all of the folks at Zen Center, who for a long time tended to be either Jewish or Catholic in their background, had come from traditions that were heavily prescriptive, and people wanted to get away from that. So they weren't hauling their kids to the Zendo by the ear and making them sit, you know.
Yeah.
They were letting them see what mommy and daddy like to do in the Zendo, but that was about it. So there aren't so many kids at Zen Center now. There are a few, but there used to be quite a few more. And they were definitely part of the community, but they weren't necessarily being more than just very, very, very gently instructed.
Mm-hmm.
And notwithstanding that, most of those Zen kids, something has taken root in them. Not exactly practice. I don't know what to call it necessarily, but I remember at Tassajara when I was a tantra there during the summer. I was giving a class on something, and I said something about looking into the Song of Jyomir Samadhi says it's like a mass of fire, just to depict it in Nari Gorms, because it's like a mass of fire. And I was talking about sitting in and gazing at the fire. And one of these Zen kids raised her hand and said, "Excuse me, is there anywhere you can look that isn't the fire?" I thought, whoa. Weird. Is there anywhere you can look that isn't the fire?
Oh.
And I thought, hey, that's pretty good. Where did she get that? She's like 14. And I'm like, I don't know where she got that. But it's like, that's pretty good. So something, you know, some of that seed, that spirit, which of course is the crucial part,
mm-hmm.
is there, is alive. And this person at least seems to have some resonance with that. If, for instance, here there were more kids, we'd develop more stuff for kids. But some people would say, well, because you don't have stuff for kids, there's no kids. Although I don't have that impression. I have more like, feel like, well, this seems to appeal to an older crowd, by and large. And the young people who, same at Zen Center, the young people who come through Zen Center tend to come for a little while and then go off and do their life, which is perfectly natural. And I heard from somebody that my teacher now does not spend much time with the youngest students, because they're constantly doing this. They have to be very enthusiastic for like a year and a half, and then they're gone. So he tends to spend more of his time with the older folks. And that's okay, but I also wonder about, you know, how are we making sure that each generation has equal and ample access to the study of the mystery? Maybe it's enough just that they hear about it, just to hear about it, that it's possible, is enough. And then, just in the ancient world, not everybody took these initiations. Some people did, some people didn't. It's always been that way. So that perhaps hasn't changed. But for us to make sure that we're not just handing on a corpse without the instruction set that says, this is how you bring it to life, that's pretty important. So, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing with my daughter, who's three.
Mm-hmm.
She started getting nightmares about 6 months ago. So now you have to sleep with her or stay with her.
Mm-hmm.
So my partner really doesn't do anything and try to help her. And he's Baptist. So he doesn't really... He's not a practicing Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
But for a while then I was meditating on my own room. You know, away from everybody. Now I just, you know, if she's in front of me, she's in front of me.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't shy away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't put it in her face.
Right.
I'm going to sit down and meditate. You know,
but
she
can see you.
She knows what I do occasionally.
She knows what you do.
Uh-huh. So one time she came over and she just sat in my lap.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know.
That's pretty good. And if your Zazen can just embrace that, then there's no problem. There's no problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of an initiation. And whether or how that may bear fruit in later years, you can't really control. Baptists used to have kind of an initiatory experience. The baptism used to be a big deal. Again, the focus, I think, tended to be affective and historical. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it was invalid or anything. It just means it's a little slippery, you know. And then you had all these people who had to, at some point, come before the congregation and announce that they had backslid. But now they were back and they were right with God. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, it's all right. But I do, obviously, I'm concerned about the corpse and keeping it, you know, from just being a zombie. And you're helping in just that way. And if we had more kids around, we could see and think and wonder and ponder how to make sure that they could see the hands pointing at the mystery. And that's enough. Just to make sure that they have that experience is all we can do. We also don't want to set the bar too high. So maybe that was partly what you experienced. The bar is awful high here. I'm carrying kids and I'm supposed to jump over that bar. It's like, that's maybe not so reasonable. On the other hand, if it's too low, you wind up with a corpse again. So where the bar is and how you go about making sure that it's neither too high nor too low is an ongoing challenge, and not just for us, for every tradition, I would say. Well, tomorrow's Easter. I plan to go to church. And since I go so rarely, it's actually a very, often very powerful experience. Even though it bothers me to see people chatting and fidgeting and looking at their Kindle during the service and stuff. But still, it's quite powerful. And I just hope that for other people also, there's been enough mystagogy in their lives that they kind of know, the mystery is right over there and I can study it. And that's, if they know just that much, that can be enough. Yes?
When I went to Ladakh and I went and visited a nunnery, and during their kind of ritual, it was that way. I mean, they didn't have Kindle then, but you know, people were kind of, the women that were, you know, kind of the nuns were, they were talking amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They'd get up and go out and presumably to go to the, you know, to go relieve themselves and
right.
then come back in the middle of. At first, I was kind of amazed, you know, but
yes.
with the comparison between this and, you know, what I was accustomed to,
yeah.
and you know, but then it ended up seeming kind of lovely in a way, kind of just this organized chaos, loosely organized
right.
chaos,
right.
and you know, somehow everybody had their book on the right page when it was
mm-hmm.
time to recite
mm-hmm.
this or that, and then this. Also bore somewhat of a resemblance to the churches in Mexico that I went into, the Catholic churches, where
mm-hmm.
which are very, I mean, you know, just the trappings are kind of overwhelming in some of those churches, and there too, people were kind of following intermittently
mm-hmm.
what was going on, but
mm-hmm.
in the middle of the service. You know, in the middle of the kind of the recitations, in the middle of the sermon, whatever, there was a lot of coming and going.
Yeah, right.
Which again, I was kind of surprised at, but it just seemed to be kind of cultural.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of how they did it. They would show up when they could. They would, you know, leave when they wanted. They would give some money to the people sitting outside the, you know, on
right.
the steps outside, and
right.
So I thought, well, you know, it's somehow. It's
something
happening for them
yeah.
in each of these situations. You know, something is happening for them that
yeah.
makes them feel enfolded in the
right.
you know, in the tradition
right.
in some kind of way.
Right. Yeah. In spite of or because of the chaos, I mean, who knows? I mean, I've been to Tibetan events too, where you know, they're chanting, and then that side's chanting, so this side's chatting with each other. You know, it's kind of, or their kids running around. You know, mm-hmm. doesn't seem to bother anybody. You know? It's quite a contrast to the Dead Tree Hall, where people are very still and very silent. It's all dark. You know? And ironically, of course, in Zen, at least, the image of the corpse is actually used as a symbol of, on one hand, practice of renunciation, and on the other hand, also practice that is not yet alive. So the contrast is quite sharp with more energetic and expressive styles, which can also encompass mystagogy. Whether they do or not, again, is always the question. You know, it's not. There's no way of knowing. So in Buddhism, it tends to be the teacher tends to be the mystagogue and pay attention to the initiatory experience of the student. That tradition is much weaker in the West and Western faiths, as far as I know. So.
It also seems to me as if for a great number of people involved in whatever faith tradition, that mm-hmm. the main thing is kind of this, kind of almost this cloak of protectiveness or mm-hmm. something. You know, to be under the protection of the tradition is mm-hmm. is almost kind of the most, you know, the most motivating
yeah.
for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, and of course there are social and cultural elements that are quite important in the fabric of people's lives and community and so forth is not to be disparaged at all. It's very important. And that was surely part of the whole mystagogic picture in the ancient world as well. Well, I don't have any solutions in mind. I just thought I'd raise the issue. And we can go eat cookies and kill ourselves. any more questions? Happy Easter and Passover. And are there any other holidays I'm missing?
Earth Day.
Was that, what, yesterday? Day before? Mm-hmm. Yesterday? Mm-hmm. Happy Earth Day. The colors of the mountains are the Buddha's true body. And we hope they're not going to be, like, wrecked by, what is that called, fracking? That process of blasting...
Mountaintop removal.
Thanks a lot, guys.